EcoReport is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
EcoReport is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Hello, and welcome to EcoReport. For WFHB, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Juliana Daly. A study from the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health published in the journal Environmental Health, concluded that women living in rural central Indiana with high levels of glyphosate in their urine were more likely than other women to have shorter than normal pregnancies. Glyphosate is the active ingredient in Monsanto's herbicide Roundup. Shorter pregnancies make children susceptible to reduced learning abilities and brain development. Glyphosate is linked to many health issues, including cancer, birth defects, damaged DNA, endocrine disruption, and reproductive problems. Currently, hundreds of lawsuits, many filed by farmers, allege that exposure to Roundup caused their cancers. The study tested 71 pregnant women in central Indiana, one of the areas in the Midwest Corn Belt, which produces half the country's corn crop. Over 90% of the women had glyphosate in their urine, and women with higher levels of it were more likely than others to have shorter pregnancies.
This study follows last month's news that the U.S. Department of Justice had approved the merger of two giant transnational chemical companies, Monsanto and Bayer. Bayer is buying out Monsanto for over $62 billion. That's the largest all-cash buyout in history. The mega merger represents an increased effort to promote pesticide-dependent, genetically modified crops around the world. It also places more pesticides on the market and in our food. Moreover, the Monsanto-Bayer conglomerate will own about 33% of the world's commercial seeds. It will have a near monopoly on vegetable seeds and own about 75% of corn and cotton seeds. Today, only 10 companies own 73% of the world's commercial seed supply. The near monopoly on seeds also means that Monsanto, Bayer, and similar mega corporations can raise the price of seeds at will and determine what seeds to make available to farmers and gardeners. The mega merger is projected to create a huge reduction in seed diversity and availability around the world.
According to a report by the American Wind Energy Association, or AWEA, U.S. states that voted majority Republican in the last presidential election are leaders of wind energy usage in the U.S. Texas is the largest wind energy producer in the country. Texas and the other four top wind energy states, Iowa, Kansas, Oklahoma, and South Dakota, voted red in the last presidential election. Those five states derive over 30% of their electricity from wind turbines. As a whole, the country obtained just over 6% of its energy from wind last year, enough to power 27 million homes. The AWEA says all five of the best performing states are plain states with lots of wind. Wind technology is improving. Turbines are becoming larger and therefore transforming more wind into more electricity more regularly. What's more, wind turbines are becoming less expensive, according to the AWEA. The price of wind power fell by 67% in the last 9 years.
The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, will allow Nestle Corporation, the world's largest food and beverage company, to withdraw 400 gallons of groundwater per minute from an Osceola County well, despite almost 82,000 objections from the public. Only 75 public comments were in favor of the permit. Nestle was withdrawing 250 gallons a minute from the well already and marketing it as Ice Mountain bottled water. The DEQ insists the permit meets the requirements of the Michigan Safe Drinking Act. Lisa Wozniak, Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, said about the deal, quote, "Sadly, the DEQ chose to give the green light to a foreign company to continue pumping Michigan water virtually unchecked," unquote. A good part of the public outrage about the permit stems from the fact that Nestle obtains the groundwater for only $200 a year.
Meanwhile, the state of California is likely facing another year of water woes. The Sierra Nevada snowpack, which supplies up to a third of California's water, is at just 41% of normal mass this year. Spring precipitation ends in early May, so scientists project that the season will end up with a significant shortage. California faced years of drought from 2011 through 2016. Fortunately, 2017 saw exceptional precipitation, and public reservoirs are still full despite the low snowpack.
The new State of Global Air report from the Health Effects Institute, an independent nonprofit research organization, states that 95% of the global population is breathing polluted and potentially harmful air. The results of breathing in such pollutants can mean more heart and lung disease and cancer. The report estimates that over 6 million deaths come from air pollution each year, over half of them in India and China. The Institute issued a State of Global Air report once before, but this latest report is the first time it included indoor air pollution, which comes about from burning such solid fuels as dung and wood. 1 in 3 people around the world is exposed to such pollution. Another major threat is industrial coal burning. For many in the global south, indoor air pollution enters the outdoor environment, worsening the already dirty outdoor air. Ozone, formed when nitrogen oxides mixed with warm air, remains a constant problem in the U.S.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb penned a letter to President Donald Trump on Friday asking for 36 counties across the state to be declared major disaster areas. Flooding in February across the northernmost and southernmost counties in the state has resulted in over 1,800 homes sustaining flood damage. The designation by the federal government of the situation as a major disaster could open the door for federal assistance and relief in the form of emergency funding and insurance protections. 6 Hoosiers died as a result of February flooding. Storms and heavy rainfall beginning on Valentine's Day continued through March 4th. According to the National Weather Service, in northern Indiana, about 70% of the monthly precipitation in February fell in about 3 days, with some counties experiencing up to 10 inches of downpour. In southern Indiana, the Ohio River and several tributaries overflowed their banks.
The Indiana State Department of Health asked the Federal Emergency Management Agency for assistance. FEMA responded in 13 counties across the state. FEMA estimates the flooding resulted in nearly $20 million worth of property damage. In many places, the poor and uninsured were most heavily impacted by the floods. It's uncertain when or if the federal government will declare a major disaster in Indiana due to the flooding.
Finally, Southern Indiana's own Sycamore Land Trust has donated 14 acres of Lake Monroe shoreline to Hoosier National Forest. Sycamore Land Trust Communications Director Abby Hinkle says the nonprofit conservation organization worked on the project for several years.
This parcel is a 14-acre property. It's right by Hardin Ridge Recreation Area in the Hoosier National Forest, which the Hoosier National is over 200,000 acres. So this is an addition to that. And it's just a nice, hilly, forested property. It's right on Lake Monroe, so it's on the lakefront. And it's actually a project that was in the works for over 3 years that we had to acquire this and then sell it to the Hoosier National Forest.
Hinkle says Sycamore Land Trust planned to donate the land to the Hoosier National Forest since the project's inception. She says the U.S. Forest Service could have just bought the land themselves, but Sycamore Land Trust was able to purchase the property more quickly.
Like collaborative deals like this, something like this where the land is a wonderful piece of wooded land that we wanted to see it protected, it made sense to have it managed by the U.S. Forest Service since it's already part of the forest. That's a question we get a lot is, why didn't we just keep it for ourselves? And management-wise, it just makes a lot more sense for them to manage it.
The land is located around the south side of Lake Monroe. Sycamore Land Trust reports the land cost around $26,000. For WFHB, I'm Juliana Daly.
And I'm David Lyman. We love to hear from our listeners. Contact us about stories we've aired or if you have ideas for future stories. Please send emails to earth@wfhb.org. And now it's time for Get Out and Hike, our segment showcasing the wonderful wild areas of southern Indiana and beyond.
This is Get Out and Hike, and I'm Jan Walker.
I'm here today with Kate Welch, who's going to talk to us about Pioneer Mothers Memorial Forest, which is a part of the Hoosier National Forest. Kate, thank you for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jan. My sister and I took a little drive down to Paoli to the Pioneer Mothers Memorial Forest, and the forest is a lovely forest. It's some of the only remaining old-growth forest in the state of Indiana, actually in the Midwest, I've been told. The trees weren't as big as I expected, but it's never been logged. So there are lots of trees that have gotten old and died and fallen to the ground. And there's also lots of trees that have babies. So there's areas where there's a larger tree that looks like it's on its last leg, but it's surrounded by saplings. And there were lots and lots of wildflowers. But when we got past the memorial wall, so there's this big stone structure a mile into the trail.
Would you call it handicapped accessible?
Oh, no, it's not handicapped accessible.
Okay, so.
I consider handicapped accessible some place where you can take your chair and go along. Well, this trail immediately goes downhill.
Okay.
And
okay.
When we first went downhill, it's like, okay, on the way back, we're going to have to come up at the very end. How's that going to be? And it wasn't as bad as it okay. It seemed like it might be right. When we started out. It was like, oh, this is easy.
Yeah. Why go to a virgin forest?
Well, I wanted to see it personally because I love trees. And it's always been really annoying to me that human beings, for some reason, when they started moving around and taking over areas like the Indiana Midwest and California, the big redwoods, they'd chop all the trees down, burn them. Why did they do that? I don't get it. I just don't get it. A few years ago, my sister came to visit me when I lived in Oregon, and we drove down to the redwoods in Northern California for a couple nights. And in the redwoods, 95% of the old growth of the redwood forest has been cut down. Chop it down. If it's in your way, chop it down. Kill it. And it's not all that different than the Midwest, where it's been reported that when the first European set foot on the American continent, the North American continent, it were trees from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River. And southern Indiana does have forest cover comparatively. Brown County is pretty well forested. But when you get up to northern Indiana, no, the forest is pretty much gone. And in 1820, it was forested with the exception of the prairie and the wetlands.
All right. Well, thank you, Kate.
You're welcome.
This week, WFHB correspondent Norm Holey interviews Dr. Indra Frank from the Hoosier Environmental Council about her recent testimony to the EPA about coal ash contamination in Indiana.
This is Norm Holey for WFHB, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Indra Frank. She's a medical doctor, and she works for the Hoosier Environmental Council. She's the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director. And she recently spoke to the EPA regarding some rules changes that they wanted to make regarding coal ash lagoons. And that's certainly a big topic in Indiana since we have more than any other state. So what's the background on coal ash lagoons?
Good to be with you today. Once coal has been burned, there's an ash that's left behind. It's a waste product of burning coal. And unfortunately, it has toxic heavy metals in it, things like lead and mercury, arsenic. And those were there as trace elements in the coal. But once we've burned the coal and burned off most of the carbon, they're in higher concentration in the ash. So the ash has to be disposed of carefully. Otherwise, it could contaminate water. So that's the the big issue with it. Here in Indiana, we actually have more coal ash ponds than any other state in the country at about 86. And these ponds are formed when the ash is moved by water out of the power plant. So they're using water to rinse it out, basically, and then you wind up with this mixture of ash and water stored in an impoundment with a dam or a berm around it. Most of the impoundments in Indiana are not lined. And just last month, March of this year, groundwater data was released from our coal ash sites, actually looking at, you know, groundwater where the coal ash is being stored. And what we see in that data is that at every place we are disposing of coal ash and we don't have some kind of a liner under the ash, we're getting contamination of the underlying groundwater.
Why were they ever allowed to dump this stuff without a lining? I mean, even for our trash, all of that stuff is lined so that any heavy metals, batteries, et cetera, don't leach down into the groundwater. So
right, yeah. The United States didn't have federal laws regarding waste disposal until 1980. But even then, and of course, a lot of our power plants were built prior to that, but even at that time, they were given exemptions. There wasn't any regulation of coal ash until 2015. That's the first rule we've had in the United States regarding coal ash disposal.
So what did you emphasize in your testimony to the EPA?
Sure. Well, so as I mentioned, the first regulation of coal ash was the 2015 federal rule. With the administration change last year, the utilities sent requests to the EPA to actually change some of that 2015 rule. And Scott Pruitt then directed the EPA to draft revisions to the coal ash regulation. So those revisions were put out for public comment in March. And there was one hearing. The EPA held a single hearing on these proposed revisions to the rule. And I was able to travel to Washington, D.C. to attend that hearing. The proposed revisions would weaken the coal ash regulation. It would weaken protection of groundwater. It would weaken some of the cleanup requirements. It would weaken requirements for responses to coal ash spills. It weakens the requirements regarding locations where coal ash can be disposed of. So it would weaken the requirements regarding floodplains, wetlands, or fault zones. And it could potentially even remove some of the transparency that we have on coal ash from the 2015 rule. So I've testified against this weakening of the coal ash regulation, and I also, in my testimony, emphasized the impact that we're already seeing to groundwater in Indiana from coal ash as, you know, a strong reason why we need to make sure that going forward we're protecting our water resources and we don't weaken those protections.
Now, did I get this right? So there was no public comment meetings in the state of Indiana regarding this change? It was only
So not only are they proposing to weaken the coal ash rule, they are trying to move that change to the rule as rapidly as possible. So the EPA had initially told one of the courts that they would be offering a 90-day public comment period, but they shortened that to 45 days and then held just the single public hearing. When the 2015 coal ash rule was written, there were public hearings at a variety of locations around the country and a much more extensive process for public input.
So what is the extent of groundwater contamination in the state of Indiana?
Sure. So we have data from 15 power plants around the state, and at some of those locations there's more than one coal ash impoundment. And at all 15, we are seeing contamination of the groundwater. It's less at the locations that had liners under their coal ash, and in some instances, substantially less. And it's interesting, there's a variety of heavy metals that can be present in coal ash, so it varies somewhat which of those metals will show up in the groundwater at which location. We're seeing arsenic, boron, molybdenum, lithium, lead, those are the kind of the major ones. And in looking at the groundwater data, so my colleagues and I have gone through all of those groundwater reports, and we're comparing the groundwater data to standards that are based on health, so standards for drinking water primarily. So anytime I refer to one of those spots as having contamination with one of those metals, what I mean is contamination that exceeds what would be safe in drinking water.
If the groundwater is contaminated, are the samples taken at varying distances from the ash ponds?
That's a really good question. And what your question points out is that groundwater doesn't sit still, it moves. So once it's been contaminated, you can wind up with that contamination moving in the groundwater. The answer is no. At these power plant coal ash disposal sites, so far they have monitoring wells just immediately adjacent to the edge of the coal ash. So they've measured it there, but they haven't measured at a further distance. Now, we do have a few places in Indiana, though, where people with private wells have had their well water tested. There are actually four locations that I know of where the utilities are having to replace drinking water for people whose wells were contaminated by coal ash.
I'd like to thank you very much for the interview. I've been speaking with Dr. Indira Frank. She works for the Hoosier Environmental Council, where she is the Environmental Health and Water Policy Director. Thank you very much for your comments.
You're welcome. It's very good talking with you.
Are you looking for a way to take action on environmental issues? Ecoreport Report is seeking volunteer reporters to contribute short headline news stories as well as feature interviews. We provide all the technical training you'll need. WFHB also offers internships. Give us a call at 812-323-1200 or email us at earth@wfhb.org. And now we'll hear In Nature, our weekly segment covering the plants, animals, and seasons of southern Indiana. In Nature is written and recorded by EcoReport contributors, past and present.
This is In Nature.
Yellow jackets are in the Hymenoptera, or membranous wing order, and are endowed with clear wings. Like bees, they are golden yellow and black. Unlike bees, wasps do not die when they sting and can sting multiple times. They usually make paper nests in holes in the ground. The paper is formed from bits of tree bark mixed with saliva. If you examine a nest, you will be able to see the individual mouthfuls that help create the hexagonal cells that house the larva. Only fertilized yellowjacket queens overwinter and start new nests in the spring. There is one queen in each nest, and her eggs hatch into female workers, which she tends until they can help her. Adult females feed on nectar and capture insects to feed to larvae. They help the gardener by pollinating in plants and killing insect pests. People often notice yellow jackets and their nests in the fall, when the colonies are in chaos. Newly hatched fertile females and males, incapable of doing the work of the hive, roam widely searching for sweet liquids, including the sodas and juices of picnicking humans. Because yellow jackets never reuse the same nest, if you find one in the fall, there is no need to call an exterminator or to use insecticides. The animals will soon be gone.
You've been listening to In Nature, a production of WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
This week in our listening area, enjoy a Wings and Wildflowers hike at the Porter West Preserve located on West Vernal Pike in Bloomington on Saturday, May 5th from 10 a.m. to noon. Spring brings new life to the landscape, including wildflowers and migratory birds. The varied habitats of Porter West include pond, scrubby bottomland, and upland forest. RSVP at sycamorelandtrust.org.
There will be a Morel Mushroom Festival on Saturday, May 5th at Brown County State Park. Join in for a day of fun to celebrate the season's delectable edible bounty. Learn all about mushrooms and buy some morels to take home.
Leaf It to Me, a conservation hike, is scheduled for Sunday, May 6th at Leonard Springs Nature Park. Take a quick jaunt through one of Bloomington's most beautiful and diverse parks and learn how to keep it that way. You will also learn actions you can take at home to preserve the environment around us for our enjoyment and some of our most endangered critters. Wear comfortable shoes for hiking. Register at bloomington.in.gov/parks.
Plan to take a Cali Nature Preserve guided hike on Saturday, May 12th from 10 a.m. to noon in Jennings County. The Cali Nature Preserve is a 179-acre property situated along the Muscatatuck River. The preserve contains high-quality limestone cliffs, waterfalls, mesic and dry mesic upland forest. Red-shouldered hawks and hooded warblers both nest on the site. Wear appropriate clothing and footwear. Bring water, sunscreen, and bug spray. There are no restroom facilities. Contact Jason Larson at jlarson@dnr.in.gov to register and for more information.
A special Mother's Day wildflower stroll is scheduled at Springmill State Park on Sunday, May 13th, from 3 to 3:45 p.m. Discover some of the beauty beneath the treetops. Join Sherry for this easy hike leaving from the Lakeview Activity Center. For more information, call the Springmill State Park Nature Center. And that wraps up our show for this week. Eco Report is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar-powered generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This week's headlines were written by Norm Holey, Linda Green, and Wes Martin. Rebecca Mueller edited the script. Jan Walker produced Get Out and Hike, and Cindy Bolle edited the segment.
Wes Martin engineered today's show. Juliana Daly compiled our events calendar. Our producer is Rebecca Mueller. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm David Lyman.
And I'm Juliana Daly. Join us on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. after making contact, and Fridays at 5 p.m. following the afternoon music mix for our weekly radio rundown of ecological news. You can also access headline news, feature audio, and archived Get Out and Hike episodes anytime on WFHB.org.
You've been listening to the Eco Report,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
Eco Report is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana,
bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the Eco Report staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.